90.3 in Lake Geneva. WPR News from Gateway Technical College.
Today on Code Switch, NPR.
This is WGTD HD serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, a program that's designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first Saturday of every month.
Good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I am here today with Crystal Redman, who is the operations director from Redman Farms. And she's a rather inquisitive sort of person and came up with a number of technology-related questions that she thought would be helpful to a variety of business leaders. And since Crystal's in charge of the technology leadership as the technical point of contact sort of person for the Redman Farms, you know, she came up with these lovely questions and sent them to me. And I'm like, wow, those are really good ones for the show. So do you have a question that you want to discuss with me today, Crystal, and get to the bottom of some answers?
Oh, so many, Felicia.
Okay.
So many.
Okay, so randomly, just so everybody knows, you have not told me what the question is, so this is going to be totally off the cuff. Let's go.
That's how our relationship has been so far. One of my biggest burning questions is understanding network segmentation. I kind of get it. I understand why there's different Wi-Fi networks for our business, all that good stuff, but I need to know more. Like, how does it improve security? Are there some common mistakes that people make when they're implementing this? What does the typical person need to know?
It's an excellent question. And the reason I think it's such an excellent question is because network layer security is the foundation. It's absolutely the foundation. It's like when you're doing a house, you know, you have to have a lovely hole. The hole has to be compacted, and you have to have a lovely concrete foundation in there. And it has to be all, you know, level and square and everything. And if that isn't right, then everything else doesn't work quite right. So the network is what everything else runs on. You need that network to be correct. And network segmentation, specifically micro segmentation, is actually better. There's a wide variety of ways to do it. And I like to focus on things that are the lowest total cost of ownership in terms of methodologies and things that are the most sustainable. So that means that level of security or that type or that approach can be attainable for even a very, very, very small organization of, let's say, a business broker who works out of their house, you know, as a single individual. So that means we can bring enterprise grade security level approaches to even a one person office. And that kind of approach is very important because a lot of the other network segmentation approaches are economically infeasible at that scale. Okay, so the way to think about segmentation is you are going to treat and classify your jewelry box different than your underwear drawer, you know, different than your bookshelf, different than your refrigerator. These are all different types of assets that you're storing in these different places. And so you need to treat them differently. I mean, nothing's going to end well if you take your underwear and your jewelry and your books and your, you know, your food and you stick them all together. Certainly these are just, right? I mean, these are different things that have different needs. You know, the books need to be on the bookshelf with their other books, and they can't be having milk next to it, getting it all wet. Same with your underwear, you know, and you know, jewelry, we typically want that to be a little more protected. And so the idea of micro segmentation at its core is a concept that says we're going to understand the assets, and then we're going to enable the assets to do what the assets need to do, like a TV on a guest network, for example. needs to be treated differently than a corporate laptop. But that's different than a printer, you know, and that's different from a switch. These different things have different requirements. And so if you create a security zone profile sort of concept around these and you segment them, it becomes very easy to create a security profile for the segment that the printers are on. You can say, well, my rule is I'm only going to put printers there. Now I can create a security zone profile that protects those printers from being tampered with or hacked externally, but also helps those printers avoid data leakage. Like a printer, for example, could have, let's say it got a piece of malware on it, which is totally possible. That can happen. But then everybody that's printing, every one of their print jobs might get leaked to some, you know, unauthorized parties. And that's highly undesirable. And so as a result of trying to avoid a situation like that, you need to restrict what the printers can communicate with and thus restrict what they can send data to. And now some devices like a TV, that's what you would call an IoT device. The IoT devices, you try your best to create a profile of what they can communicate with, but some devices are just really poorly engineered, and most TVs, I would say, are the antithesis of anything that's able to be secured. But one of the ways that you keep corporate devices from getting ransomware is to restrict what they can communicate with. Well, if I had to go to the level of effort of mixing TVs and printers and switch interfaces and telephones and surveillance cameras, you know, and company computers, right? Corporate laptops. Oh, and guest devices. If I had to do that all on the same subnet, do you think I could protect anything?
Probably not.
Right. It becomes very difficult it's basically practically impossible. It's impossible to do it at an economically viable level because you can't actually know what traffic is occurring on what IP address at what time. So there you go. I mean, most of IT, or I should say IT security, is this balance between trying to protect assets but still facilitating the functionality that someone legitimately is authorized to do. Notice I didn't say need, right? Because it's not up for employees of an organization to discern what they need. It's up for the security management team to listen to them and say, okay, I understand you want to do that. Now, what does company policy say about that? And then let's see if maybe there's a company policy change that needs to happen. I mean, a big example of that would have been when ChatGPT came out. I think a lot of organizations failed to appropriately have an AI usage policy before they allowed AI to be accessed in that way in their organization. And really, they just introduced a whole lot of risk to the organization. And network segmentation would have been a very easy way to turn that off, you know, if it was allowed to be turned off. But unfortunately, most organizations don't function that way. And without a governance system like a policy, and without leadership who are thinking first about risk management, you know, then those things tend to go nowhere. So what do you think about that as an answer? Does that help you understand these?
Absolutely. I'm really glad you said AI, because that reminded me of another question I have for you.
Okay, go for it.
How do you see AI being used by cyber criminals in the future? Are there new security threats on the horizon that we should be aware of that are coming? How serious is this?
I think it's wickedly serious. And I mean, I've actually already seen quite a lot of it's come out. So one of the things that's super duper cool is we have a system called the Breach Prevention Portal system, and it's effectively a large scale on-demand training platform, training and assessment platform for individuals. You know, we can deploy it for, you know, residential home users and one user businesses to large businesses. It really doesn't matter. It's really cool because we can just provide it to everybody. One of the things that comes out of that sort of interaction is that becomes a way to provide the answers to those very questions to the staff at an organization, you know, across the board, and to enable personnel managers to know that the staff have taken that class or those courses, maybe it's a couple courses, and there's always an assessment at the end of it. And how did they do on the assessment? Did they complete the assessment? So I've already seen where the criminals are using the AI. And I have to mention something else that I think is quite relevant here, is that we don't, on our company website, we don't list the employees of the company with their photos and their names and, you know, their fun proclivities or whatever. And I have seen organizations do this, and it's typically when those organizations are driven by marketing people instead of operational security people. And that type of information is absolutely harvested by the criminals. So criminals will also buy the all kinds of, like, you know, people finder lists. So using something like a service like Abine's Delete Me can be exceptionally useful to an individual to help reduce the number of lists that they're on. That service is very economical. And again, that's Abine Delete Me. I really enjoy that service. I think they do a good job at that company. And the criminals are collating all this data using AI. They're also drafting messages now that are less prone to have spelling and grammar mistakes, because now they're not having to do it. They're using AI for that. They're utilizing AI to do deepfakes. And that's the one that is really the giant meat and potatoes, is the biggest bang for their investment is when they're using AI tools to perpetrate deepfakes on people. Because let's imagine that an organization didn't have their protocols together. And if the person who, or multiple people potentially, who could be authorized to do like a large wire transfer, well, what if they were not immune to getting deepfaked and wire frauded? Well, that this is where the problem comes in. There, did you see the article about the guy who was deepfaked by like seven? He had seven people at his company that were deepfaked, and he was on the receiving end of all of this. I think they had a conference call, and he was the only, this was a video conference call, and he was the only legit dude in that meeting. Did you see that article?
No, I did not. You'll have to send that to me. That sounds horrifying. I was scared. It's terrifying, yeah. Now.
It's pretty wild. So imagine this dude. This guy was, he was like, you know, the ACH wire transfer guy at a bank. And he got deepfaked in a conference call where there was like seven other people in the, if this was a video conference, right? This was not this was a video conference.
How long did he stay on this call?
I don't know. I don't, that information was not in the meeting, but I think they got like $50 million.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. Anyway, so like this is exactly what AI is doing. So, right, if AI is that good now that it can do a video conference call deep fake in order to get this guy to make it, you know, like a very large wire transfer, this is exactly why people need, like everybody needs this kind of training that we have that's available. I mean, it's really good training we have. And I've had nothing but very positive commentary from people about like, yeah, you know, it's really cool you got AI training now, and that it's really relevant. It's really practical and easy to understand. It's like, yes, because it's a big deal. It's a big deal. So what do you think about that as an answer to your question?
Wonderful. Your answers are always wonderful. So we have AI helping cyber criminals just go wild. don't even need that much knowledge. It seems you just have AI to help you out here. I assume that means malware is probably evolving rapidly, right?
I think
we adapt our strategies to counter like these emerging risks?
Well, that, yeah, again, another fantastic question you have here. You know, I was thinking about your malware point. It's become so super duper easy for bad actors to, there's kind of like two things that they're doing, and I'm sure that I'm underselling it, right? One thing that they're doing is like scenario planning. Oh, if I ran my malware and I did this, what's the probability of, you know, penetration into said company or, you know, theft of data or whatever, right? So they're now able to do much more sophisticated scenario planning, which helps them tune and refine their attack. The second huge piece is they don't even have to be able to write code anymore. I mean, this used to be where malware coders used to actually have to write code. Now, granted, for probably at least 5 to 6 years, there have been ransomware rootkit sort of things you could buy on the dark web. So this is, you got some malicious actors who are coding wizards, and they're out there and they're basically building like a ransomware kit. And you could take a 10-year-old, and some people have done this. They'll take a 10-year-old, put them at a computer and say, okay, use this application to go make some ransomware. And so here, just a 10-year-old with a computer and this like ransomware wizard generator tool rootkit thing can go and generate their own variant. And so this is the key piece here, is that when there's, I believe there was like a 100,000 new pieces of malware every hour around the world. I mean, there's some sort of just completely outrageous statistics like that. And so that's why signature-based detection isn't that great anymore. I'm not saying that people should stop using it. I'm saying that if they're using a tool that is centric around that type of functionality, it's going to be deficient in its capability set. So what we use is we use something that's really a zero trust approach. And that's where you really got to get to at the point with malware. I could go back at least a decade, and I can tell you that even a decade ago, if a computer got some malware on it, it was done. Absolutely done. I mean, there was like no removing it. So the whole thing, when people buy, they pay the ransomware guys, and then they get their, you know, decryption keys. I mean, I just want to laugh at that type of stuff from the perspective of saying that if you think you're going to get data back that actually has integrity that you can count on, I think that's a naive thing. And I think if you also think that you're going to get usable systems from that, paying that ransomware, I think that's also a very naive approach. Because even 10 years ago, there was really no viable method for correcting a computer that had been, something malicious happened to it, other than you have to wipe the whole thing. I even saw, oh my gosh, I can tell you it was the year 2004. This was a super long time ago. It was 2004 when I saw partition persistent malware. So if you took a computer, it had this nasty thing on it, you rebuild the whole thing. And well, shortly thereafter, it was getting something nasty infecting it again. What was the one thing that continued to needed to be done there? Well, it wasn't just format the hard drive, it was all the partitions had to go too. So this is something that you have to realize. And sometimes you have to question, has somebody contaminated the BIOS on the motherboard? Has it infected a USB attached device like a keyboard or a mouse? You know, some of these monitors now have like an integrated docking station in them that has its own brain chip, effectively. It has its own motherboard, right? So you're now in the world where you have to assume that everything is a threat, and you have to use dynamic live updating databases. So we're talking about zero trust.
I have to protect my monitors now too.
Yes. Yes, you do. I mean, you've always had to protect your monitors from nasty power surges. But now monitors, monitors have firmware in them. Did you know that?
No, my mind is right now.
Okay, so
I thought it would just plug it into the wall or a power strip, and then you have a HDMI cable, you know, harmless, and just poof, we're good. I don't think about anything.
No, the HDMI cable is bidirectional in its communications capabilities. And so the monitor has firmware, and something has to be able to update the firmware. So there are, you know, various communication channels whereby a computer could do a firmware update, legit or otherwise, to that monitor. Actually, this is exactly why I have a very, very strong love for mature and enforced procurement policies. If you have a procurement policy that does not allow your team to go down to random store and procure things like a USB charger, in fact. Well, I mean, shoot, you've seen these business. You've seen these news videos. You have to have. I mean, I feel like they're like all over the place where is somebody saying, you know, do not plug into your mobile phone, you know, a random power cord.
I didn't sleep for a week after I read the article about these USB phone chargers and what's on that, what could potentially be on them and the threats they pose. My mind was blown then.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, this is one of the reasons why we use wireless phone chargers, because that's, you know, a surefire way to be successful with that. Rather than telling somebody, hey, only use the phone charger that came with your phone, I'm saying, hey, don't use the wired phone charger at all. Use a wireless phone charger. And they're like, oh my gosh, I got to buy phones that are capable of that. And I'm like, the quantity of phones nowadays that can't do that is getting even smaller and smaller and smaller. So bottom line, let's go back to zero trust. Zero trust is effectively saying we have to assume that everything is malicious until it's been inspected. And this isn't a matter of scanning. It's a matter of, do I know you? So there's a classification process. Let's say there's an unknown thing that's unclassified and it is attempting to do something on a computer. Well, the protection tools will grab that thing and they will upload it into a virtual machine in the cloud. They will execute that thing on the virtual machine in the cloud. So this is a terminology we call detonating. You know, it's detonated in a virtual machine in the cloud, and then we get to find out what happens. Does it hack that virtual machine or not? And so this is a way of doing behavior observation and outcome observation. There are also those sorts of processes that are going on all the time. Like a great example is if you have really good zero trust threat protection, then it's going to look at it and say, oh, we have Microsoft Word is invoking a PowerShell instance. What do you think about that, Crystal? Do you think that Word should invoke PowerShell?
No, why would it need to?
That's exactly right. So it smells like something malicious, doesn't it? Okay. So zero trust is like we're gonna, do we trust Word? Yes, we've classified Microsoft Word. But now we're still going to watch it. If Microsoft Word is doing something weird, then we have to think that Word, even though it's a legit tool, maybe it has a malicious plugin embedded in it or something. This is no different than if you look at like a web browser, take Edge as a web browser. It can have a malicious browser plugin. And then that malicious browser plugin can do nasty, naughty things. So we got like about 4 minutes left. So why don't you give me your next kind of small question if you have one?
Small? I don't know. antivirus software. Now, I'm thinking back to the days when I first got a computer. You know, you had that Norton CV, you push it in, and you're, as far as everybody knew, everything was great. We're protected. I guess, how has that changed since then, and how machine learning, has that impacted AI machine learning, the effectiveness of this antivirus software? Is it effective? Is it worth it? I don't know.
Well, I don't even like to use the term antivirus anymore. In fact, I pretty much stopped. As a modus operandi, I'm only utilizing the terminology, you know, zero trust threat protection, or, you know, endpoint protection, detection, and response. And the reason is because these things really cannot be unmonitored anymore. So we do NOC, SOC, and MDR, and without killing you with acronyms, it's just basically security monitoring, security response actively 24 hours a day. Now, we only do that for the clients that subscribe to that service. But that's like, you know, having a little monitor, a protection system, like having your own cop that's running around with you all the time. Like the, you know, the cop's going to watch who's coming in on your zone and should you get to go visit Crystal or not. And then how is somebody interacting with Crystal, right? That's kind of like having your own personal cop. But we use a lot of machine learning and AI for that to keep costs low. And the system is really incredible. And as a result of that, we have not had a single client get breached who was under our full management. The only times we've actually experienced issues is when, you know, other people are involved that don't have the same level of training or vigilance on this matter as we do. But I don't really use the term antivirus anymore, just simply because antivirus represents approximately maybe 10 to 15% of the kind of protection capabilities that you need just for your individual computer, right?
That was my next question. Is it enough for personal use? Do I need to supplement it with other tools? Now, something like I certainly do.
Yes. And, you know, so we get to the question of, is this economically viable? And I really feel like so many people just think about this wrong. They think, oh, well, this is only just for my home use. And it's like, yeah, but it's your bank account. You know, it's your identity. How many people do their tax return on their home computer? I mean, how many people are interacting with their bank account and their bills and their credit card and their all of their personal photos and their personal files? I mean, these are, you know, the family jewels. I would think that they would be looking at this and going like, well, I really need some enterprise grade protections here, because that's how I think about it. I'm like, how much time am I? Go ahead.
As a normal everyday person, you know, I was guilty of this before. I had no idea that all these threats existed, that I was completely naive to. You know, just go on Amazon, buy a monitor, buy a USB charger. Who cares where it came from? Not even looking at the seller. Did they just open a shop? No idea. Just purchasing because, well, I have no idea the risks that are out there. I don't know the big bad wolves out there. I do now. I think a lot of people don't know, or they don't care to know.
Yeah, brands definitely matter. I mean, I would only ever personally purchase a SanDisk or a Western Digital. That's it. And there's reasons for that. And, you know, the brand matters. You know, for me, the whole thing around that is that I think that their firmware process is done really good, and it makes those devices harder to hack. So that's cool. Well, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope that you will come back and ask me some more of these questions, because I think your questions are fantastic.
Oh, absolutely. I promise I have a lot more for you.
Okay. All right. Talk to you next time.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first Saturday of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, go to her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
I'm Gregory Berg, and I hope that you can join me for Monday's morning show here on WGTD. Monday kicks off National